This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, a million-person march against police brutality in Newark, New Jersey. Dr. Cornel West salutes the young leaders of the emerging new movement. And while you're taking down the Confederate flag, why not take down the U.S. flag, too?
But first, former New York Times reporter and veteran prison activist Chris Hedges recently wrote an article titled America's Slave Empire. The article highlights Alabama prisoners who are leading a movement for inmates to go on nationwide work strike.
They are from the Free Alabama Movement. They shut down, through work stoppages, three prisons in the state of Alabama in January of 2014. They were immediately seized by prison authorities and put in solitary confinement. That's indefinite. Solitary confinement. There's no termination date. And in Alabama, that means they are denied not only a television, but all reading material, including like magazines, newspapers. And they, at best, get out for an hour, 3 days a week, and often that doesn't happen. So that means that about 4 days out of every week, they're locked 24 hours in those cells. And their argument, which I think is correct, is that all of the attempts at prison reform and appealing to legislative bodies and courts to thwart the explosion of mass incarceration has failed, and that the only mechanism left is to shut down these prisons because they can't function without unpaid or poorly paid labor. In the case of Alabama, they don't pay them at all. So you have prisoners in there that have worked for decades, 8 hours a day, cooking food in the kitchens, doing maintenance, cleaning, laundry, or anything else. And not only are they not paid, but as with all the prison systems in the United States, increasingly they are slapped with all sorts of fines and fees, which if their family is unable to sort of send them money to pay, means that they fall deeper and deeper into debt.
It sounds like a system in which it has the elements of slavery, indentured servitude, and all wrapped up in one.
Yes. I mean, it really is slavery. I mean, you're using coercion to force people to carry out work for which they don't receive, in Alabama anyway, compensation. In the state of New Jersey, which is more typical, you get paid these ridiculous fees of $1.30 a day for 8 hours of work, $28 a month. But prisons for me, and I teach in one, really function like plantations. It can cross color lines, but of course the majority of the people in prison are of color and almost all of them are poor.
One imagines that every prison inmate is looking for a lawyer, but these guys say, and you quote them here, we aren't giving more money to lawyers. We don't believe in the courts. And they say the kryptonite to fight the prison system is the work strike.
That's it. And they are right. Because if states had to bring in compensated labor, or if states had to pay prisoners a minimum wage, then the entire system would be unsustainable. It is built on either poorly compensated or uncompensated labor. I mean, prisons are in essence run by the prisoners. I mean, all the engine of, you know, every kind of service within the prison is carried out by prison labor, and those prisons are not sustainable if either the prisoners refuse to work or they're paid fair wages.
Most people know about the existence of prison labor to benefit private corporations, but they might be surprised to know that McDonald's is one of the beneficiaries of this slave labor.
Yes, McDonald's uses prison labor. McDonald's is hardly alone. They have targeted McDonald's just because there are so many corporations out there that are now using prison labor that they can't divide their forces, so they've called for boycotts of McDonald's. But you have Target, Johnson & Johnson, Starbucks, Victoria's Secret, Hewlett-Packard, a very, very long list of corporations that see in prisoners the kind of perfect workforce. You only have to pay them 20, 30, 40 cents an hour. They can't strike. You don't have to pay benefits. They always show up on time. Any kind of disruption in the manufacturing process sees them shipped off to solitary confinement. So I think we have to look closely at the prison system to grasp what, in the eyes of the corporate state, is the model worker. And we're watching large numbers of corporations move back from sweatshops in Bangladesh or Vietnam back directly into prisons. This is especially true in the state of California.
Now, if a who's who of the corporations, the real ruling class of America, becomes so deeply embedded in prisons, well, that does not augur well for those who want to abolish the system as it now exists.
I think we've already reached that point. There are just too many corporations that are deriving their profits from the prison industrial complex. And, of course, their lobbyists are writing the legislation. Their lawyers and judges own the courts. So, yeah, I think the only mechanism, I think the leaders of the Free Alabama Movement are right, the only mechanism left is to shut the prisons down in nationwide strikes. It's not just private prisons. You have phone companies, Global Tellink, which charges usury rates for phone service. And you have to pay in advance of the account. People are paying 5, 6, 7, 8 times what you and I pay on the outside. You have all sorts of private companies, RMRs running the food services, JPay is running the money transfer services or the commissary accounts. Most prisons have not only stopped allowing families, this is true again in New Jersey, to send items like sneakers and stuff to those who are incarcerated, but they won't issue those items when people are inducted into the prison system. So you have to buy the sneakers yourself. We're seeing in states like Mississippi, where people are being charged not only rent, but now seeing a movement across the country where if someone is tasered because of an incident or because the guards want to taser you, they're charging them $26 for their own tasering. Every year, they're thinking of more ways to gouge the poorest of the poor. And families are really at the breaking point. I mean, one of the things that I find so heartbreaking about the massive amounts of profit that these phone companies are making in these usury rates is that for many children, the only connection they have with an incarcerated parent or perhaps a brother or sister is through the phone, and they're shutting that off by making it just prohibitive in terms of money.
So the model for resistance that we're looking at here is prisoners withholding their labor on the inside, and on the outside, folks boycotting and agitating and educating.
That's right. And I thought that Melvin, one of the leaders of the Free Alabama Movement, made a very good point when he said, look, we don't need to protest in front of state houses anymore. These people are working for corporations, and he, of course, included Obama on the list. If you want to carry out protests, do it outside the prisons where people are carrying out work stoppages to show your support and enforce boycotts against corporations. And they have, of course, as we said earlier, singled out McDonald's to try and begin to put economic pressure, because that's the last mechanism we have.
That was journalist Chris Hedges, whose latest book is titled Wages of Rebellion.
On July 25th, Newark, New Jersey will host a Millions March against police brutality, racial injustice, and economic inequality. The event was called by the People's Organization for Progress, POP, a mass-based grassroots organization chaired by Larry Hamm, who spoke recently in Plainfield, New Jersey.
This march is being called in response to the murder of unarmed people, men, women, and children, especially African Americans, who comprise 85 or more percent of these incidents. This march is being called in response to the murder of unarmed people by the police the brutalization and use of excessive force by the police, and the violation of people's constitutional rights by the police. It was the murders of people here in New Jersey, like Abdul Kamal, who was killed, shot 15 times by Irvington police, like Kashad Ashford, who was shot 9 times in the head by state troopers and Lyndhurst police, and by Jerome Reed, whose death went viral on a video from a police dash cam. He was getting out of his car, had his hands open and up, and he was shot to death by police in Bridgeton, New Jersey. And then we had the murder of Michael Brown, who was shot and killed by police in Ferguson, Missouri. And the choking to death of Eric Garner by Staten Island police. And it's not just men who are being killed. We have Rekia Boyd, who was killed by the police. And Ayanna Jones, who was killed by the police. And on and on and on. So the call from this march initially came out of the pandemic. Epidemic would be too mild a term. The pandemic of police murder, brutality, and torture. Just this year, a case was settled in Chicago where for years the Chicago police had systematically tortured black men. And that case was settled in Chicago recently. So that would have been enough to call a million people's march. But then we had the terrorist attack, the racist terrorist attack upon the Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina, where a white supremacist wearing the flag of the defeated and overthrown racist apartheid regime of South Africa and the flag of the racist regime of Rhodesia that had been overthrown and who himself had sported Confederate flags on many occasions, was welcomed into the Emmanuel AME Church, welcomed with open arms by people that were praying, welcomed into that church, sat with those people for an hour, and then he took out his weapon and he fired again and again and again. And when he ran out of bullets, he dropped the clip, put in a fresh one, and continued to fire, killing 9 people. And how do we know that this was a terrorist attack? Because he left a person alive and he told that person, "I'm not going to kill you because I want you to tell other people what happened here today." That's an act of terror. That's an act designed not just to murder the people there on the scene, but in fact to cause terror throughout the community. And that event by itself would have been enough to call upon a million people from all around the United States to gather. So we have this pandemic of police brutality. We have this epidemic of racist terrorist attacks, most notably that happened to the Emmanuel 9. But listen to this. The FBI just came out with a report and said that there were over 280,000 acts of hateful violence in the United States last year. So we're calling this Million People's March because, number one, we want to demand an end to the murder of unarmed people by the police. We're calling this Million People's March because we want an end to the use of excessive force by the police. We're calling this Million People's March because we want an end to the violation of people's constitutional rights by the police. We're calling this march not only for an end to the most heinous acts, but because we want the reform and restructuring of police in the United States of America. First and foremost, we want community control and civilian oversight of all police forces in the United States. That is critical to any effort to reform the police. Recently, in response to a Justice Department investigation and report that found that the Newark police were engaged in the violation of people's constitutional rights. This is what the Justice Department found, that they were violating people's constitutional rights, that they were engaged in the use of excessive force, that they were engaged in discriminatory behavior and disparate treatment of people based on race, because 85% of the stop and frisks were of African Americans. And most of the incidents of the use of excessive force were African Americans. But beyond that, that the police weren't themselves engaged in criminal behavior, that the drug and gang units of the police were taking the money and drugs from the people that they put in jail and going back and selling it themselves for their own profit. This is what the Justice, this is not what Larry Ham found. This is what the Justice Department found. And in response to that, the U.S. Attorney for New Jersey, Paul Fishman, has called for a federal takeover of the Newark Police Department, called for the implementation of a consent decree, which is a schedule of reforms and a federal monitor. The Newark Police cannot be trusted to run themselves. They need a federal monitor. And so when the new mayor, Ross Baraka, was elected, he did not resist the Justice Department's implementation. He, in fact, embraced it. And after more than a half century of Newark residents demanding a police review board, Ross Baraka signed an executive order creating a police review board in the city of Newark, which will become effective sometime this fall. So we're here to demand civilian and community control of police, civilian oversight and community control. We want the implementation of legislation right here in the state legislature of New Jersey. They got a chokehold bill. They should pass it. Right here in the state of New Jersey, they got a bill to create a special prosecutor for cases of police brutality. We want them to pass it. Right here in the state of New Jersey, in the legislature, in the assembly, there is a bill requiring residency requirements that the police should live in the cities and communities that they patrol. They need to pass that bill. So we call for the passage of those bills in the state legislature, but at the federal level, there's the End Racial Profiling Act, which would make racial profiling by the police a federal offense. We want that bill passed. So we want this and other legislation. There's a whole list of legislation and bills that we could talk about and we'll talk about at a later date, but those are some of the most important ones. And that's some of the things we want done with the police, but we can't stop there. We got to deal with this issue of racial injustice in America. And although it is an act of symbolism, we join with our brothers and sisters and with Sister Bree Newsom throughout the South saying that the Confederate flag must come down from all public institutions in the United States of America, not just in front of the Capitol building in South Carolina.
Larry Ham of the Newark-based People's Organization for Progress.
Activists from around the country gathered in Manhattan to make plans for 3 days of protest against police terror, October 22nd through the 24th. The meeting was called by Carl Dix and Dr. Cornell West, co-founders of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. Carl Dix explained the urgency of Rise Up October.
We got to do this because black people continue to be targeted by racist killers in and out of uniform.
Yeah.
And this must stop. Charleston, 9 people massacred in a church during a Bible study session by a killer who said, "I have to do this because you are raping our women and taking over our country." White supremacist lies. We also have to do this because this whole system goes into motion to exonerate killer cops when they murder black and Latino people, and that must also stop.
Yes.
Now, when this massacre went down in Charleston, they started saying, "Oh, well, this was a crazy lone wolf."
Yeah.
No, that wasn't the deal, sisters and brothers. The rage that drove him was nurtured by the white supremacy that has coursed through the veins of America since the very first Africans were dragged to these shores in slave chains. And this same white supremacy is what nurtures the climate in which police feel justified in exchanging racist messages on social media and then going out into the neighborhoods and brutalizing and murdering black and Latino people. Charleston concentrates America. And it concentrates the slow genocide targeting black and Latino people in this country. Now, we've got to talk a little bit about forgiveness and coming together. We've got to talk about that because that's what they keep telling us that we should do in the face of these attacks. That talk is aimed at helping this system keep things under control. The governor of South Carolina explained what the deal was on that when she talked about why they were going to move to take down the Confederate flag. She said, and this is a quote, "If nothing happened, boycotts and other ugliness could follow." Now, by other ugliness, she meant people might take their rage to the streets, which is ugly to the rulers of this country, but it's beautiful to those of us who want to see these racist attacks stop. See, in reconciling with these people falls into a ruling class trap that aims to smother our rage, to just push it on down so that it can't find expression. You cannot end oppression by forgiving your oppressors, by coming together with them. And let's talk a little bit about hate, too, because they said, "Oh, don't hate. Don't respond to this with hate." Well, it depends on what you hate. You should hate oppression. You should hate these racist massacres.
Yeah.
You should hate hearing about another young person gunned down, choked to death, beaten to death by the cops, who then get away with it. In fact, you should hate it so much that you're rage around it moves you to act to stop it. And let's talk a little bit about healing. I ain't a doctor, but I do know that you cannot heal until you diagnose the disease and root it out. Otherwise, you're just covering a festering sore. The disease is white supremacy rooted in the capitalist imperialist system. And it is not time to come together with the folks who preside over that system and the white supremacist attacks that it brings down on black and Latino people. What it is time to do is to draw a huge dividing line in society over these outrages and to challenge people. Which side are you on? There ain't no room for neutrality here. Don't tell me you're standing in the middle when on one side you got people who are fighting against this injustice, and on the other side, you got the people who are bringing it down. You are either with the people who are standing up and saying no more to these attacks, or you're with the folks who are bringing them down, and it's okay with you that this happens. We have to respond to these outrages, but we've got to go beyond responding each time they do another outrage. We have to take our resistance higher. And a crucial part of doing that is getting on a mission to bring thousands and thousands of people into the streets of New York City October 22nd through the 24th. Here is what we're talking about doing. 3 days of powerful, determined resistance. Demonstrations in cities across the country on October 22nd, the national day of protest to stop police brutality, repression, and the criminalization of a generation. The many lives that have been stolen by killer cops and the system that backs them up will be featured in these outpourings, bringing to life, putting a human face on the devastation that killer cops have wreaked onto so many families across the country. That's going to be the first day. The second day, October 23rd, there's going to be a major nonviolent direct action here in New York City that targets an institution that concentrates the slow genocide of police terror and mass incarceration targeting Black and Latino people in this country. It's going to be involving well-known people, and it's going to, in its own right, highlight the resistance to this slow genocide, and it will point to what's going to happen the next day, October 24th. And on that day, thousands and thousands of people from around the country will descend on New York City and join up with thousands and thousands of people from New York City and take to the streets and say, no more to police terror. Deliver that message to people around the country and put it before the eyes of the world. And through the sheer weight of our numbers, shutting this place down.
Yeah.
That was Carl Dix of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. Dr. Cornel West, the other founder of the network, said, "The emerging movement against police terror has finally gotten the missing ingredient, youthful activism and leadership."
But let's be very clear, it's the young folk of all colors, but disproportionately chocolate, who are at the center of this movement in the last year or so. It's Ferguson, it's Baltimore, it's Staten Island, it's New York. Yes, we all live together, but it's been very much a new school leadership, and I like that. Yeah. Learn from Ella Baker. The days of the messianic model of the head Negro in charge, that's old. Been trying to tell Brother Sharpton that for a while. Trying to tell all of the old Black leadership that messianic model is over, because you all are easily co-opted, easily brought in, easily incorporated. We want grassroots leadership. We want indigenous leadership coming out of the local context. And those of us who are at a national level, we just render our services. Whatever skills and insights and gifts we have, because each and every one of us ought to be specialists in being servants of the people.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
When Huey Newton talked about that, that wasn't no joke. To put the people at the center and ensure that their voices are heard. And then at the same time, let them know that they come from a tradition of a people who, when they put the voices of the people center. You see, I come from a Black people been terrorized for 400 years, traumatized for 400 years. Our whole tradition is what? Lift every voice. We a blues people. You can't be a blues woman unless you find your voice. We a jazz people. You can't be a jazz man unless you find your voice. Exactly. Give it up for the young. Oh, we love you in the back. We love to see you speak to you. The fundamental aim of the powers that be is to reduce the voices of the people to being echoes of the oligarchs.
Yeah. And if you're just part of an echo chamber, then all you can do is fall into conformity and fall into complacency and fall into the cowardice that keeps the system going. When you find your voice, you have already decided to be courageous. You've decided to be a love warrior. And when you're a love warrior, you cut against structures of hatred, of dehumanization, of devaluation, any system and any act that loses sight of the precious humanity of other people, no matter where they are. That's why we're internationalists. Not captured by the waving of the flag. See what happened the other day in Charleston. When I look at Charleston, I see Denmark Heavey.
That's right.
Buddy Emanuel, he was the founder of that church.
That's right.
I look on the vanilla side of town of Charleston, who would I see? Angelina Grimke.
Yeah.
One of the great freedom fighters whose father was a slaveholder. Her sister Sarah, they had to leave South Carolina. She married a brother named Theodore Well, and they wrote a classic in 1838 called Slavery as It Is, that laid out slavery not as some form of system of subordination in the abstract. They described the labor as a species of torture. They describe it as legalized terrorism. That's what it is. Don't let American corporate media tell you that some talk about terrorism began in 1911. No, it started in 1492. Yeah. It's indigenous people, 1619, African people. America's always had a history of legalized terrorism and torture. That's what Angelina was saying. And Angelina comes from the ruling class. She committed class suicide. Because she fell in love with everyday people. And she fell in love with a hated people, black people. And that's one of the great contributions that we black people have made to the world. Be so intensely hated, and yet teach the world so much about it. And it is true, my brother, about forgiveness. Premature forgiveness is a twisted effort at sympathy. It's a pathological form of empathy. But what it also does, and this is why I think we might disagree, we don't have time for it, not a seminar at the moment. I start with John Coltrane's Love Supreme. That's my starting point. That's true. Jesus Christ, love you. Jesus, love you. Black man, sorry, God. Black church, but the Love Supreme simply says, when you are hated so, you say what Emmett Till's mother said in Chicago in August 1955 when her baby was in the coffin. What did you say? What you gonna say, Mama Till? She said, I don't have a minute to hate. I will pursue justice for the rest of my life. So you keep the love pole, but you got a fighting pole. The problem of Charleston was when somebody kills your grandmama and the next day you forgive them, it can't be real forgiveness. It can't be genuine. It can't be authentic. You got to work it through. You got to work it out. Love the person you put in the grave, mourn and grieve, but at the same time, emerge as a fighter.
That was Dr. Cornel West of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. Dr. West teaches at Union Theological Seminary in New York.
The Confederate flag seems to be coming down in many places in a wave of revulsion to the massacre in Charleston, South Carolina. But journalist and Real News Network host Dr. Jared Ball reminds us that the United States flag is the banner under which blacks were enslaved long before there was a Confederacy, and that black people were lynched, Jim Crowed, and incarcerated in the millions under the Stars and Stripes. Why only vilify Confederate President Jefferson Davis and not all U.S. presidents as well? Dr. Ball posed that question to Dr. Gerald Horn, professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston, and to Marshall Eddie Conway, a former Black Panther Party political prisoner and now a producer on the Real News Network. The first response comes from Marshal Eddie Conway.
I think you're right that we need to look at the institutionalized racism in America, and we need to look at the policies on the federal government level, and we need to look at the economic interests on the world level, and you'll find out that, of course, white supremacy and white extremists have always subjugated people of color throughout our history, throughout the history of the United States, and it is in that vein that they accept a certain privilege, a white skin privilege, in which they can kill or do whatever they need to do to all other people on the planet and take the resources of the people on the planet. The Confederate flag is used to symbolize that, but that Confederate flag goes all the way up to the North Pole, and it covers all the people, but it doesn't cover the working people. I make a distinction because, like, the ruling class or the people that own the means of production, that owns the machinery that's controlling most of the wealth, which is like a very small percentage of the population, but a large percentage of them are Europeans. There's no question about that. But they are using the race card. They're using the worker card. They're using religious cards. They're using other cards to constantly misdirect us and have us arguing about the Confederate flag in the South. That Confederate flag is flying over Chicago. Those attitudes are flying in all Africa and South America and everywhere else that you have white supremacy. And so we need to recognize that as a distraction toward who's really making the gains, who's really getting the benefits from this kind of arrangement. And it's the problem with the social arrangement and the economic arrangement that exists.
You know, Professor Horn, we had been talking off air about extending Malcolm X's previous metaphor about the Mason-Dixon line being the Canadian border up into, as Mr. Conway said, to the Arctic. I'm wondering, you know, again, you have some forthcoming work on Haiti. And again, the Haitian Revolution and all the negative policies that have come regarding the United States and Haiti since then was not about the Confederate flag. In other words, the Haitian Revolution was not against the Confederacy. It was against Western imperialism and ultimately the United States itself in a later part of that struggle. Could you respond to my long introductory question of a moment ago and offer your concluding thoughts on this matter?
Well, I think the underlying subtext of our conversation, including the implicit, if not explicit, critique of some of our friends on the left, is that there's a fundamental misunderstanding of the nature and origins of the United States of America. And if you have a misdiagnosis, then obviously it's very hard to come up with an accurate or adequate prescription. What I mean is that the founding of the United States was a joint project by slave financing interests north of the Mason-Dixon line, particularly in New York City and Boston, and slave owning interests south of the Mason-Dixon line, particularly in South Carolina. And the revolt against British rule came not least because there was a perception that London was moving towards abolition of slavery, not least because with regard to its sprawling empire, it was becoming much more dependent, just like the Spanish empire, upon putting rifles and bayonets into the arms of Africans. Whereas in North America, amongst the settlers, they felt that rifles should only be pointed at the backs of Africans to march them into the fields to pick cotton and tobacco. And because we have this fundamental misunderstanding, because many of our friends on the left continue to feel that the Bill of Rights somehow was designed with us in mind when it was actually designed to suppress us, it becomes very difficult to have an adequate understanding or comprehension of contemporaneous events in South Carolina, or for that matter, anywhere else in the world. And so you are correct to suggest that we need to get to the nub of the question, which is actually the genocidal origins of the United States and how historically, in order to beat back that kind of predation and oppression, it's required a movement of global proportions, which is now lacking.
That was Dr. Gerald Horn of the University of Houston speaking on the Real News Network.
The chief of intelligence of the Central African nation of Rwanda was arrested in Britain last month on a warrant issued by a Spanish judge Karenzi Karake is charged with overseeing mass murder, including the killing of three Spanish citizens, part of an ongoing genocide that has taken the lives of 6 million Congolese since 1996. The arrest of Karake has caused a great embarrassment for the government of Britain, which is a prime supporter of the Rwandan regime. We spoke with Claude Gatabuke, a Rwandan genocide survivor and founder of the African Great Lakes Action Network.
Karenzi Karake is the leader of the national intelligence in Rwanda, both military and civilian, and he is one of 40 high-ranking members of the Rwandan military, the Rwandan government, who served with Paul Kagame, the president of Rwanda, during their rebellion in the early 90s and the invasions of the Congo in the late 90s and in the 2000s, so up until now, who are accused of major crimes, genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity. And it started with the assassination of three Spanish aid workers that worked in Rwanda and Congo in the late 90s. Karenzi Karake is accused of ordering their assassination. And it is a great embarrassment to the British authorities because the British government is the number one donor to the Rwandan government in terms of budgetary support and foreign aid. The Rwandan government depends heavily on foreign aid. 40% of its budget is foreign aid. And the British have provided support in multiple ways. One, diplomatically. Two, political shielding of those who have committed massive crimes, such as the crimes Karenzi Karake is accused of. And they've also provided funding. So even when Rwanda was invading the Congo and causing mayhem to the tune of 6 million people who died, and to the tune of 3 million of those victims being children under the age of 5, the British government continued to support Paul Kagame and the RPF. And today, former aid minister of Britain, Andrew Mitchell, has been in the media supporting Kagame and denouncing the arrest of Karenzi Karake. Also, the defense team for Karenzi Karake, for General Karenzi Karake, includes former British Prime Minister's wife, Cherie Blair. And Tony Blair is a big supporter and defender of Paul Kagame. He's a lobbyist for Paul Kagame. But of course, Tony Blair, it's not the first time that Tony Blair has been on the wrong side of history. He also, a little over 10 years ago, led the world to believe that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and plunged Iraq into a war. So it's not the first time that he's been on the wrong side of mass atrocities. And Karenzi Karake specifically is also accused of things that are so gruesome, things like mass incineration of bodies in Rwanda, which we know this is a practice. There are witnesses and from those who were actually ordered to perform those duties, but also from people who sold those incinerators. He was the leader of the terrorist attacks that rocked Rwanda in the early 90s prior to the genocide, where grenade attacks or bombs were set off in public places, markets, public transportation areas where there were thousands and thousands of people gathered, and explosions would be set off and kill people. And I remember personally seeing one of the victims and survivors of such atrocities. This was sometime in 1993. I was at the Kigali Hospital, as known as the CHK Hospital, for a procedure. And I saw this woman from a distance. She looked white from a distance, and Rwanda is 99.99% black. You know, everybody's black and dark-skinned, actually. And so as she got closer and closer, she spoke very fluently in Kinyarwanda. And then she came over, you know, on her crutches. She could barely set her feet on the ground. And as she sat down and started to tell her story, she told of how she was on a bus where a bomb, one of those bombs, you know, one of those operations that Karen Zakarake was leading, killed people on that bus, and she got burnt. Her whole body was burnt. She was missing all of her skin. That's what I was seeing. And as a little boy who was barely 12 or 13, I thought she was white, but she actually had, you know, lost all of her skin to those type of atrocities. Those are the type of things that Karen Zakarake has been involved in. So there has been a lot of jubilation in terms of finally, there may be an end to impunity when it comes to the RPF, the Rwandan Patriotic Front, and the Rwandan Patriotic Army of Paul Kagame, where they have enjoyed impunity. They have not faced any consequences for any of the massive crimes that they've committed over the years against Rwandans and Congolese. And the irony is that he's been arrested in the country that supports the regime the most.
And this came about because of a Spanish court acting for two reasons. One, the doctrine of universal jurisdiction when we're talking about the crime of genocide, but also the deaths of three Spaniards at the hands of Karake and his henchmen.
That is correct. The investigation that led to the arrest warrants of the 40 high-ranking military members of the RPF were set off by the assassination of the three Spaniards that worked in Rwanda in Congo. The families of those slain Spaniards sought justice, and the Spanish judiciary is responsible for following through and persecuting anyone that commits crimes against people from Spain, like many countries actually have that kind of jurisdiction. And so as the investigation started and they started peeling the covers on what happened, actually, they were killed in the context of massive atrocities that were being committed by the Rwandan military and the Rwandan government in the late 90s after the genocide. And the doctrine of universal jurisdiction allows for prosecution of the crimes of genocide or international crimes, international atrocities, especially when these crimes show that there was ethnic cleansing that was taking place. There are all these massive atrocities and war crimes that are prosecutable under the doctrine of universal jurisdiction. And it just so happened that the investigation into the assassination of the three Spaniards led to the uncovering of those other crimes that are covered under universal jurisdiction. So there are two jurisdictions, actually, that the Spanish courts are acting on.
Now, let's make it very clear. These charges have not been brought by the International Criminal Court, the ICC, which seems to have worked over the decades hand in glove with the Rwanda regime.
That is another great embarrassment, actually, that it takes a national jurisdiction when there is an international body like the International Criminal Court that should have prosecuted these crimes and hasn't. The ICC has looked the other way as long as it's existed on crimes committed by the RPA and the RPF, crimes committed by Kagame and his henchmen, crimes committed by General Karen Zakarake and his colleagues in the Rwanda military. To the tune, again, millions of people have died. And this is something that is under the jurisdiction of the ICC. And the ICC has not prosecuted these crimes. They have not gone after the actors like they have with, for example, the president of Sudan or former president of Ivory Coast, Laurent Gbagbo, or former president of Liberia, Charles Taylor. And so it's a major disappointment that the ICC, that has jurisdiction to go after these crimes, there's no lack of evidence, of course, has not gone after these crimes. And that all has to do with political will. I think that if the British and the Americans and the French and all the leading countries in the U.S. Security Council wanted these crimes prosecuted, it would have happened. And that shows to the extent that the ICC is influenced by international politics and not necessarily by matters of justice. It is great that at least a national jurisdiction is going after such crimes, that the victims' lives were not lost in vain, that there will be justice, and that those who committed these crimes cannot continue to enjoy total impunity.
Now, you pointed out that Britain is the largest donor of aid to Rwanda, but I believe that in terms of military weapons, the United States is the greatest arms master.
I know one thing for sure. The United States is second in terms of being a donor nation to Britain. The United States taxpayers contribute $200 million every year to aid that goes to Rwanda, approximately $200 million. And the United States do provide military training and the military support to the Rwandan troops. And actually, that kind of support may have been in violation of the U.S. law, the Leahy Amendment, that bars the United States from providing or working with suspected war criminals like Karenzi Karake. And Karenzi Karake was the leader of the UN peacekeeping force in Darfur in 2007, 2008, and I believe 2009. And during those years, the United States was contributing money to the UN mission. And that is potentially a violation of U.S. law that bars doing that. The U.S. is definitely a major supporter. The U.S. has previously blocked the release of reports that show the types of atrocities that Paul Kagame and Karenzi Karake and others, such as General James Kabarebe, who's the Minister of Defense in Rwanda, General Jack Nziza, who is the advisor to President of Rwanda, General Charles Kayonga, who was the military chief of staff in Rwanda previously, when there was evidence showing that they financed, supported, recruited for, and provided logistical support, and actually commanded rebellions in the Congo, and those militias that they were supporting were killing thousands and thousands of people, taking sexual slaves, using child soldiers, I mean, just breaking every international human right that there should be for any human being. And the UN mapping report of 2010, released in 2010, also documents over 600 incidents, almost 700 incidents. And this is only, and I repeat, only major incidents. So if we talk about other incidents, there are thousands and thousands of those incidents. In those almost 700 incidents, the UN mapping report said that Rwanda, the troops of Rwanda, may have committed genocide in the Congo. And again, it talks about the selection of the weak and the blind and people who had nothing to do with war, and just gathering them and killing them, sometimes with hand weapons, sometimes burning them. And again, Karenzi Karake was one of the leaders in the Rwandan military who were leading some of these operations. There was also the Rwandan and Ugandan troops fighting in Kisangani that killed thousands of Congolese people. This is so embarrassing and ridiculous that you had two foreign militaries fighting inside of another country for a mine. This happened in 2000, 2001. Karenzi Karake was involved. So the international, the U.S. cover, for example, U.S. support for the Rwandan government goes way, 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 way back in terms of just diplomacy again. Even media, the reports, the UN mapping report was only released because it was leaked to the media. The report that showed that the Rwandan government was commanding and providing all kinds of support to the M23 rebellion that displaced almost 1 million people in the space of 3 months was only released because the media leaked the report, and there was a lot of pressure both from ordinary American citizens and the media to have the report released. There are report after report, document after document, that just shows the kind of crimes that Terence Karake is accused of and that he should definitely face justice for, along with the 39 others who are also wanted. I think every single one of them should, at a minimum, get the justice that they denied their victims when they killed them in groups or sometimes by themselves.
Yes, the United States and Britain and their corporate media want the world to believe that only one genocide occurred, and that was in Rwanda in 1994, and that 6 million Congolese did not die in a Holocaust committed by U.S. surrogates and clients.
Right, and I am a survivor of the genocide in Rwanda in 1994, and I saw how gruesome that was, and barely made it. So many times I was faced with death. So many times I was either close to being shot, hit by a bomb, or killed by machetes, to the point where I even had to, at one point, I was ordered to dig my own grave with my mother. There were many incidents where I knew it was the last, and somehow I made it. And so I know how terrible it can be. I can still smell the stench, the stink of human flesh. And so to imagine that 5 million people, 6 million people died. People deny that there was a genocide in the Congo, where the UN mapping report clearly documents where certain ethnic groups of the Congo, like the Congolese Hutus, with the Rwandan Hutus, were selected and killed on the basis of ethnicity. It's mind-boggling, but I think it's changing. There's no way you can bury the truth. It may take a long time, but a fact is a fact, and it doesn't change. I think that it's a losing battle to continue to perpetuate the myth that the only genocide that took place in the Great Lakes region of Rwanda was that was committed by the extremist Hutus, which is what I survived, which, yes, that was a genocide because Tutsis were targeted on the basis of their ethnicity. But to go beyond that and say that there was no genocide committed by the RPF, by the Rwandan Patriotic Front and the Rwandan Patriotic Army against the Hutu population in the Congo is a big lie that cannot hold water.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.